There are men who grow old beneath the weight of years, and there are men who grow old beneath the weight of one memory. Charles Sterling, Duke of Ashcroft, had done both. He was 60 years old in the autumn of 1879, and he wore those years the way Ashcroft Abbey wore its stone heavily, without apology, and with the particular kind of silence that comes not from peace, but from long practice at enduring. His hair had gone silver at the temples long ago, and spread from there until it covered everything. His face was cut with lines that other men his age called character, and Charles himself called evidence. Evidence of Parliament sessions that stretched past midnight. Evidence of tenant disputes settled in freezing estate offices. Evidence of 12 winters spent walking the corridors of a house too large for one man, listening to rooms that used to answer back. Ashcroft Abbey sat in Northumberland, like something the earth had decided to keep. It rose from the moorland on three sides, and faced the valley on the fourth, its towers dark against whatever sky the season offered. In summer, the stone turned warm amber in the late afternoon light, and the grounds bloomed with the care of 12 groundsmen who had served the estate longer than most families had existed. In winter, the mist came down from the high moor and settled over the abbey like breath on cold glass, and the whole estate became a world unto itself, walled, ancient, and almost dreamlike in its quiet. The house had survived wars. It had survived plague years and political upheaval, and three generations of Sterlings who had managed, each in their own way, to spend more than the estate earned and leave behind more debt than dignity. Charles had repaired all of that. He had come into the dukedom at 32 and spent the better part of three decades restoring Ashcroft Abbey to something that could be called prosperous again. He had done it with Margaret beside him. Margaret Sterling, née Prescott, had been his duchess for 19 years before a fever took her one January morning in 1867. She had been sitting up in bed when Charles left for his morning ride. She had asked him to bring her back a sprig of winter heather from the north field, the small purple kind that grew near the old shepherd's wall. He had found it. He had brought it back. By the time he reached her room, the physician was already there. 12 years had passed since that morning. Charles had not entered the East Wing since. He had not opened the ballroom. He had not uncovered the portrait of Margaret that still hung in the upper gallery, draped now in black velvet so thick that not even the frame was visible beneath it. He attended Parliament when Parliament required him. He hosted formal dinners when duty demanded it. He reviewed the estate accounts every quarter and the tenant petitions every month. He fulfilled every obligation the dukedom placed upon him. He had simply stopped living the parts of life that were not obligations. His steward, Archibald Warren, managed the day-to-day details of Ashcroft Abbey with the smooth confidence of a man who had been trusted completely for too long. Warren was 55, gray-haired at the edges, with a manner so quietly proper that guests often mistook him for a lesser relation of the family rather than a paid employee. He appeared at Charles's elbow with information, managed staff with firm courtesy, and handled tenant matters with the kind of efficiency that Charles, distracted by his own grief, had never thought to question. The household staff of Ashcroft Abbey moved through their duties the way water moves through old stone, finding the channels already worn for them, never making unnecessary noise, never disturbing the Duke's particular brand of silence. They were loyal people, good people. But they spoke softly in corridors out of habit. And that habit had become, over 12 years, something very close to mourning. It was into this house, this carefully maintained, emotionally frozen, profoundly lonely house, that Violet Clark arrived on a Wednesday afternoon in October, when the rain had been falling since morning, and showed no intention of stopping before dark. She came in a modest hired carriage, the kind that left her knees aching from an 8-hour journey. She had one trunk, a leather satchel worn soft at the corners, a letter of employment from Lady Beatrice Sterling, the Duke's elderly aunt, written in the older woman's extravagant looping hand, and smelling faintly of lavender and ink. And a face Charles noticed this from the top of the Abbey steps, before he had any reason to be noticing her face at all, that was composed in a way that seemed practiced rather than natural. The kind of composure that comes not from a quiet life, but from learning how to keep steady when the ground beneath has already shifted. She was 25 years old, dark-haired, slight but not fragile, dressed well enough to suggest education, and not well enough to suggest money. Charles was standing on the Abbey steps, because Warren had mentioned the new companion's arrival, and he had come out, he told himself, simply to ensure the household was prepared. He had no reason to be standing on cold, wet steps, watching a hired carriage discharge a young woman he had not met. He was doing it anyway. What happened next was entirely the fault of Lady Beatrice's dog. Pickwick was a small, white, deeply self-important Bichon Frise, who had belonged to Lady Beatrice for 7 years, and who operated under the firm conviction that rank applied to humans, but not to him. He had been waiting in the entrance hall when a footman opened the front door to admit the arriving carriage, and in the half-second that the door stood open and every human attention was directed outward, Pickwick had made his decision and acted on it. He shot through the gap, like something fired from a cannon. He hit the wet gravel at a run, bypassed the carriage entirely, and disappeared into the ornamental hedge border, near the east drive, with the focused energy of an animal who had been planning this particular escape for some time, and had selected his moment carefully. Every footman on the steps looked at every other footman. None of them moved fast enough. Violet Clark moved fast enough. She had barely stepped out of the carriage, her boot not yet fully on the ground, when Pickwick shot past her skirts. Without pausing to assess the situation, without waiting for permission or instruction, without asking whose dog it was, or whether it might be safer to leave the matter to someone else, she simply turned and went after him. She went through the hedge, into the rain, after a small white dog who appeared to regard being caught as a personal insult. She caught him near the stone wall that bordered the kitchen garden, tucked him under one arm despite his indignant wriggling, and turned back toward the Abbey. She was soaked through. Her dark hair had come loose at one side. There was a small smear of mud on her cheek, and a long, wet streak across her skirt where Pickwick had apparently decided that escape was worth some sacrifice of dignity. The dog himself was still wriggling, but less convincingly now, as though his spirit had given way to the reality of being held firmly by someone who clearly had no intention of letting go. Charles watched her come back across the gravel toward the steps. He had not moved. He was not entirely sure why. She came up the bottom step and looked up at him with dark, calm eyes. Rain was running down her face. She did not seem to notice. "You should have called a footman," he said. His voice came out colder than he intended. It often did. Violet looked at him steadily. Then she looked at Pickwick. Then, back at him. Pickwick did not seem inclined to wait for one. "Your Grace." The dog sneezed. Charles looked at the animal under her arm, who had the expression of someone who had fully committed to an embarrassing situation and was now attempting dignity. He looked back at the young woman holding him. The correction in her tone had been gentle, not disrespectful, not sharp, not the careful shrinking he was accustomed to from people newly arrived at Ashcroft. She had simply told him the truth, as though it were the most natural thing in the world. He said nothing further. He turned and went back inside, but he noticed her. He told himself he did not, and he noticed her anyway, and that small contradiction was the first crack in 12 years of practiced stillness. Lady Beatrice Stirling received Violet in the yellow sitting room with the enthusiasm of a woman who had been waiting for interesting company and would not pretend otherwise. She was 73 years old and chose to present herself as somewhat older and considerably more forgetful than she actually was, a strategy that had served her well for 2 decades, and which she had no intention of abandoning. "My dear child, you are soaking wet," she said, which was accurate. "I am," Violet agreed, which was also accurate. "Pickwick, I presume." "He is very fast, my lady." "He is very inconvenient," Lady Beatrice said, "which amounts to the same thing." She waved a hand at a nearby chair. Sit. Mrs. Holloway will bring tea and something dry. You shall tell me about yourself when you are warm, and I shall pretend I do not already know everything. Violet sat. Pickwick, released at last, walked three deliberate circles and settled on the hearthrug, as though the whole incident had been planned for his own amusement. Violet had been engaged through correspondence arranged by Lady Beatrice, who had known Violet's late mother, Eleanor Clark, years ago. Eleanor had been a woman of gentle birth and modest means who had married a man with a respectable name and insufficient income, and who had died when Violet was 19, leaving behind a daughter with a solid education, a genuine mind, and very few options. The options had narrowed further 6 months ago. But that was not a story Violet had any intention of telling tonight. She sat by Lady Beatrice's fire and let the warmth reach her. She noticed the house around her, the weight of it, the silence underneath the courtesy, the way the servants moved with care rather than ease. She noticed a painting on the wall of this room that depicted a woman in green, laughing at something outside the frame, painted with the kind of unguarded affection that only a devoted artist or a loving husband produces. The plaque beneath it read, "Mio Sterling, 1858. She noticed that the painting in this room was uncovered, but she had passed another in the upper corridor, larger, more formal, in the main gallery that was draped in black velvet to the floor. She noticed that no one had mentioned this. She noticed that she was already deciding not to ask. That evening, as the rain continued and Ashcroft Abbey settled into its night routines, Violet lay in her room in the guest companion suite on the second floor and listened to the old house breathe. Wind came through old stone differently than it comes through new construction. It had more to say. She thought about Charles Sterling, the cold precision of him on the steps, the way he had looked at her and then away, quickly, as though looking too long was a discipline he had trained himself to break. She thought about the covered portrait in the gallery. She thought about the particular quality of the silence in his house, which was not the silence of emptiness, but the silence of something held very, very still. She had come to Ashcroft Abbey to disappear. She had chosen it because it was far from London, because Lady Beatrice's offer was genuine, and because a place already saturated with one kind of sorrow might have no room to notice hers. She had not expected to feel, on her very first night, the faint and dangerous sensation of a story beginning. She closed her eyes. Down the long corridor, past three closed doors and the covered portrait of Margaret Sterling, Charles sat in his study, with a glass of brandy he had not yet touched, and a fire that was burning down to coals. He was thinking about nothing in particular, which was what he always told himself when he was thinking about something he refused to name. The rain tapped against his window. He went to bed. In the morning, he was a duke again. Controlled. Purposeful. Appropriately distant from the young woman who had arrived with his aunt's lapdog tucked under her arm and rainwater on her face, and a directness in her dark eyes that he had absolutely no intention of thinking about further. He thought about it for 3 weeks. The abbey changed when Violet was in a room. It did not change, obviously. It did not change in ways that could be reported to Charles's steward or noted in the household log. It changed the way light changes when a curtain is drawn back a few inches, not dramatically, not all at once, but enough that the room no longer felt the same as it had before. Violet read to Lady Beatrice every morning after breakfast. She read newspapers, correspondence, poetry, and occasionally the novels that Lady Beatrice claimed were entirely too dramatic while simultaneously requesting the next chapter. She read with feeling not performance, but genuine engagement, the kind that made the words live rather than simply pass through the room. She learned the names of every servant within her first 4 days, not as a social exercise, but because she genuinely wanted to know them. Mrs. Holloway, the housekeeper, who had been at Ashcroft for 22 years and kept the household running with the precision of a woman who considered disorder a personal insult. Thomas, the first footman, who had a habit of looking at his boots when he was worried. Agnes, the young parlour maid who coughed in the mornings and tried to hide it. Violet noticed Agnes's cough on the third day. She mentioned it to Mrs. Holloway on the fourth. On the fifth day, a physician arrived from the village. She had not been the one to send for him. She had been walking past the study when she heard Charles giving the instruction. His voice was quiet and entirely matter-of-fact. Send for Dr. Wallace for the parlour-maid. The one who has been coughing as though attending to the health of a young servant with a most natural act in the world, requiring no acknowledgement or praise. Violet stood in the corridor for a moment after his voice stopped. Then she walked on. She began to adjust the map she had been drawing of him in her mind. Charles Sterling appeared at meals with the reliability of a man fulfilling a contractual obligation. He sat at the head of the long dining table in the formal dining room and worked through the courses with quiet efficiency, and spoke when spoken to, and occasionally offered observations about Parliament or the estate that were precise, considered, and entirely without warmth. He treated Lady Beatrice with a deference that was genuine rather than obligatory, asking after her comfort, ensuring her chair was always properly positioned near the fire, ordering sugared biscuits to be placed beside her tea every afternoon, because Lady Beatrice always forgot she liked them until they were placed before her. Lady Beatrice never seemed to notice this particular kindness. Or rather, Violet observed, after several days she noticed it perfectly well, and chose to say nothing, which was not the same thing at all. Charles did not speak to Violet at meals. He acknowledged her presence with a slight inclination of his head when she entered and when she left, which was the appropriate social acknowledgement from a duke to a paid companion, and he asked after Lady Beatrice's health in a general way that could, if generously interpreted, include Violet in its scope. Archibald Warren attended the formal weekly dinner on Fridays. He sat at Charles's right and spoke with the comfortable authority of a long-trusted employee. He managed information at the table the way a skilled card player manages his hand, revealing what served his purpose, keeping the rest face down. Violet watched him. She was not yet sure why. It was in the third week that the library fire happened. Violet had been asked by Lady Beatrice to locate a specific volume of botanical illustrations from the West Library, an old, generously proportioned room-lined floor-to-ceiling, with books that had been collected by four generations of Sterlings, with more enthusiasm than organization. She found the botanical volume and, since Lady Beatrice had already retired for the evening, began looking at it herself. Then she found a shelf of estate records adjacent to the botanical section, which struck her as unusual placement, and she pulled one volume out to look, and then another, and then the fire burned down and she did not notice. And when she looked up next, the room was dark, except for two low coals, and the moonlight through the long windows, and the book was open in her lap, and she was asleep. She did not hear Charles enter. She was aware of warmth settling over her, sudden weighted smelling of wool and smoke, and something underneath that her sleeping mind identified before she was fully conscious. She surfaced slowly. The fire had not come back, so the warmth was coming from above, from something placed across her shoulders. She opened her eyes. Charles was close. Very close. He had leaned over her to arrange his coat, his own coat, which he had removed and placed across her like a blanket, and he was near enough that she could see the firelight on the silver of his hair, the careful lines of his face. The way his expression was doing something complicated that resolved itself very quickly into nothing at all when he realized she was awake. He straightened immediately. She sat up, holding his coat around her. The room was very quiet. The estate records book was still open in her lap. "You are kinder than you wish people to know," she said. The words came out before she had decided to say them. They were simply true, and she had always had a poor habit of saying true things. Charles looked at her for a moment. His expression was controlled, but something in it was not quite steady. "And you are more observant than is safe," he replied. He left without taking his coat. Violet sat in the cold library for several minutes after he was gone, his coat still around her shoulders, the fire entirely dead, the estate records book still open in her lap. She looked down at it. She had been reading it before she fell asleep, she remembered now. She had been looking at coal delivery records for the past quarter and finding something that did not quite add up. She turned back to the page she had been reading. Deliveries listed as completed. Full payment recorded in the accounts. But Agnes had mentioned last week, while bringing coals to the sitting room, that several of the tenant cottages on the north side of the estate had been short of fuel since September. Agnes had said it quietly, matter-of-factly, the way servants speak about things they consider none of their business to formally report. Violet looked at the delivery records again, then at the payment records, then at the dates. She closed the book carefully and put it back exactly where she had found it. She returned Charles's coat the next morning through Mrs. Holloway, with a note of thanks that was precise and brief and gave nothing away. She spent the afternoon reading to Lady Beatrice and thinking about coal deliveries and the way Archibald Warren had positioned himself between a waiting tenant widow and the Duke's study door last week, smooth as oil on water, redirecting the woman before Charles had any occasion to hear what she had come to say. The following Friday, Pickwick distinguished himself at the formal dinner by climbing onto Archibald Warren's chair while Warren was momentarily absent and refusing to vacate it. Warren returned to find the small white dog seated with tremendous dignity in his place. Lady Beatrice said, "Pickwick has always been an excellent judge of seating arrangements." Charles looked at the dog. Then, at Warren standing beside the chair with the expression of a man who could not, in polite company, say what he wanted to say. Then, briefly, at Violet, who was looking at her plate with the careful neutrality of someone working very hard not to smile. Something shifted in the air between them, quick as a breath. Gone before it could be named, but it had been there. Later that evening, Violet walked back to the West Library alone. She found the botanical volume Lady Beatrice had wanted and set it aside for the morning. Then she stood for a moment, looking at the shelf of estate records, her hand resting on the spine of the volume she had been reading the night before. She thought about what she had found. She thought about what it might mean. She thought about the fact that she was a companion, paid, unmarried, socially precarious, and that raising questions about a long-trusted steward's accounts would be dismissed at best, and dangerous at her worst. She took the volume down and tucked it under the botanical book. She would look more carefully, but she would be certain before she said a word. As she turned to leave, she noticed something she had not noticed before. Tucked inside the back cover of the estate record volume was a folded piece of paper, small. The handwriting on it was fine and feminine, faded with age but still legible. She unfolded it carefully. It read, "The letter Charles must read when he is ready. B. S. will know where." She looked at the initials. B. S. She thought of Lady Beatrice Stirling. She thought of the way Lady Beatrice sometimes paused in conversation with a private expression, not vacant, but inward, as if holding something back. She refolded the paper and placed it back exactly where she had found it. She walked back to her room through the dark corridor, past the covered portrait of the late Duchess, and did not sleep for some time. Lady Beatrice had a gift for creating circumstances. It was not a gift, she advertised. She performed it behind the cover of slight forgetfulness and a social calendar that required considerably more assistance than it actually did, and she deployed it with the precision of a woman who had had 73 years to develop her technique. On a Thursday afternoon in November, she remembered a book she was quite certain she had left in the old conservatory. The conservatory occupied the eastern corner of the Abbey's ground floor, an enormous Victorian glass structure built by Charles's grandfather and largely unused in recent years, since the weather had made the latch on the main door unreliable and no one had thought to repair it. She remembered this book with great urgency. She expressed her certainty that Violet was the only person who could possibly locate it. Violet went. The conservatory was a strange room. Even empty of flowers and with most of the plants long since removed, it had a quality of hushed drama glass walls on three sides, the moorland visible through them, the sky close and heavy. There were wrought iron tables, a tiled floor in green and cream, the ghost of a more elaborate household in every cracked pot and empty trellis. She was still looking for the entirely non-existent book when the storm arrived. It came the way Northumberland storms always came quickly, without much introduction, and with genuine force. Rain hit the glass roof all at once, like a decision being made. Lightning came through the south-facing windows in great white sheets, turning the room silver, turning the moors beyond into a photograph of themselves. The thunder followed immediately, deep enough to feel in the chest. Violet turned to leave and found that the latch on the main door had decided this was an excellent moment to demonstrate its unreliability. The handle moved. The latch did not. She tried it twice, three times. She put both hands on it and applied force that she was fairly certain would have been adequate for most doors. The latch remained unmoved, communicating the particular stubbornness of old Victorian ironwork that has not been maintained and has no intention of being hurried. She was not precisely frightened. She was something adjacent to frightened, aware of the smallness of the glass room against the size of the storm, aware that she was alone, aware that if the weather grew worse, the glass above her would become concerning. She pressed her back against the door and breathed steadily and told herself to think practically. She heard the external door open. Charles came in through the second entrance, the one that connected to the ground floor corridor, with a lantern in one hand and his coat thrown over his shoulders. He stopped when he saw her. She watched him take in the situation. The stuck main door. The storm. Her position against it. The expression she was trying and mostly failing to make calm. He crossed the room to her. He handed her the lantern, took one look at the latch, and removed his gloves. She watched his hands, careful, deliberate, working the mechanism with the direct attention of a man who expected the world to yield to sufficient concentration. His fingers were long, scarred on one knuckle from something old, deft in their movements, despite their stillness everywhere else. He had the latch moving in under a minute, but when it moved, her hand was also on the handle. She had reached for it at the same moment. He got it free and their fingers met in the cold space around the iron, both of them stilled. It was not an embrace. It was not anything that could be described to anyone who had not been in that glass room with the storm around it and 12 years of practiced isolation between them. It was the accidental warmth of one hand against another in a cold space, and it lasted perhaps 4 seconds, and neither of them moved for those 4 seconds. His hands were warm. She had not expected them to be warm. "You are freezing," he said. His voice was very low. She was. She had been in the cold room for nearly an hour. She was shaking slightly, though she had not admitted it to herself until he said so. "Then do not let go yet," she said. He did not. He did not immediately step back. He stood close, his hand warm around hers on the cold latch, the storm making its considerable noise around the glass, the lantern making a small warm circle on the tiled floor between them. He looked at her, not past her, not at the door, not at some middle distance, at her, with an expression that was not cold, that had never, she was beginning to understand, been genuinely cold, but had been managed so well for so long that it had learned to resemble cold from the outside. She could feel his breath. She could feel the warmth of him close in the cold room, and the steadiness of his hand, and the restraint in his stillness, the active effort of a man who wanted to do something, and was choosing, with enormous discipline, not to do it. Then he let go. "Come inside," he said. "Before you become ill." She came inside. Mrs. Holloway produced tea and a dry shawl from somewhere, and Charles disappeared back into the Abbey's ordinary routines, and nothing was said about it by either of them. But that evening at dinner, Violet noticed that Charles had asked for the conservatory latch to be repaired by morning. It was repaired by morning. 2 days later, Violet saw the name Lord Sebastian Vaughan in a society column from London that Lady Beatrice had been sent by a distant cousin. The column mentioned Sebastian in the context of a charity event in Mayfair, describing him as the accomplished Lord Vaughan, whose elegance of manner is surpassed only by his precision of taste. Violet put the paper down on her knee and looked at the fire for a long moment. Lady Beatrice, from behind her own letter, said nothing. But she watched. Sebastian Vaughan had been 28 when Violet first met him, 3 years ago. He had been handsome in the way that men who know they are handsome often are carefully, with an attention to detail that was almost theatrical. He had pursued her with the specific intensity of a man who had decided what he wanted and considered the question of whether she wanted it as well to be something she would eventually come around to. Her family had approved of him. Her mother's sister, the only family Violet had remaining by that point, had told Violet she was the luckiest girl in 3 counties. The arrangement had been all but official. What Violet had discovered, quietly and over several months, and with the particular clarity of a young woman paying very careful attention to a man who believed she was not, was that Sebastian Vaughan was someone different in private than he was in public. In public, he was charming. In private, he was possessive in ways that had no language. Yet, in 1879, but that Violet's body understood long before her mind had organized it into words. He had opinions about where she went, what she wore, who she spoke to. He had expressed these opinions pleasantly, and with complete confidence that they were entirely reasonable. He had begun to make decisions about her future, as though consulting her were a formality already cleared. She had ended the arrangement in March. Her aunt had called her foolish. Sebastian had called her ungrateful. Several of their mutual social circle had called her ambitious, which was the particular cruelty reserved for women who reject what they are supposed to want. Sebastian had called her his. That word, in his mouth, had told her everything she needed to know. She had taken Lady Beatrice's offer within a week of it arriving. Now she sat in Lady Beatrice's sitting room and looked at his name in a London society column and felt the old tightness in her chest that she had thought distance would cure and apparently had not. She folded the paper and set it aside. That night, someone slid a note under the door of her room. It was not signed. The handwriting was unfamiliar, careful and neat, in a way that suggested deliberate disguise rather than natural hand. It read, "Leave Ashcroft before your past arrives with a carriage and witnesses." Violet read it twice. She sat on the edge of her bed in the candlelight and read it twice, and then set it face down on the nightstand. Pickwick, who had taken to sleeping at the foot of her bed under the apparent assumption that Lady Beatrice would not notice, lifted his small white head and regarded the note with deep suspicion. "You disapprove," Violet said. He sneezed emphatically. "Yes," she agreed. "So do I." She did not tell Charles about the note. She was not yet certain who had written it. She was not yet certain what it meant. She folded it and placed it in the lining of her satchel, with the systematic care of someone who has learned to keep evidence. In the morning she came down to breakfast, and Charles looked at her face from across the table and knew, with the instinct of a man who had spent 30 years reading people whether he wanted to or not, that something had frightened her. He did not ask. He watched her throughout the meal with an attention he did not bother to disguise, and she felt it on her like warmth. She ate her breakfast. She thanked Thomas by name when he refilled her tea. She smiled at Lady Beatrice's account of Pickwick's opinion of the repaired conservatory latch. She did not look at Charles again, but she felt him looking. Lady Beatrice announced the winter charity ball on a Tuesday with the calm confidence of a woman declaring a fact of nature. "Ashcroft Abbey will host the winter ball on the 14th of December," she said, over her morning tea. "It has not hosted one since Margaret's time, and the tenants have been patient enough. Charity requires a room, and we have a perfectly good one." The perfectly good room she was referring to had been sealed for 12 years. Charles received this announcement at the formal breakfast table and said nothing for a long moment. "The ballroom has not been opened," he said at last. "Yes, Charles. That is rather the point." Another long silence. Violet kept her attention on her plate. "The tenants will benefit," Lady Beatrice continued pleasantly. "The funds raised will repair 3 cottages on the north side. The east cottage has had a damaged roof since last winter, if you were not aware." Charles was not aware. A fact that Violet suspected Lady Beatrice had calculated precisely. He agreed to the ball. The preparations took 3 weeks. Violet threw herself into them with a thoroughness that had as much to do with occupation as enthusiasm she needed. Her hands busy, and her mind directed outward, and the organizational labor of opening a sealed Victorian ballroom provided both. The dust sheets came down, the mirrors were uncovered, the chandeliers enormous, multi-tiered, with more crystal than most London establishments were cleaned piece by piece by a team of maids who worked with the careful reverence of people handling something they understood was important. The floors were polished back to their original state. Deep mahogany, so well maintained beneath the dust sheets that they needed only cleaning rather than repair. The fireplace at the north end was cleaned and tested. The curtains, midnight blue velvet, heavy as history, were aired and hung. Violet was in the ballroom on a Thursday afternoon, 3 days before the ball, making sure the floral arrangements had been properly positioned and the candelabras set to the correct heights, when she realized she was alone. She stood in the center of the polished floor for a moment and looked at the room. It was beautiful. It was genuinely beautiful, in a way she had not quite been able to perceive through the work of preparing it. The proportions were perfect, the ceiling high and elegantly plastered, the light from the windows slanting golden even on a gray November afternoon. It was a room built for people to be happy in. She had been in a few ballrooms in her life. Modest ones, county assemblies, one London event during the single season her aunt had funded when Violet was 22, and prospects still seemed possible. She remembered a particular waltz. She had never been taught properly. There had not been money for proper dancing lessons, and she had always been slightly behind the beat. She tried a few steps now, alone in the empty room, working out the pattern the way she had been doing privately for years. Cross, step, turn, cross, step, turn. The polished floor was excellent for it. The room had good acoustics, so her own footsteps gave her something like a beat. She was entirely absorbed, working carefully through a troublesome turn, when she heard someone behind her. She stopped. Charles was standing at the ballroom door. He had his hands behind his back in the posture he used when he was observing something and had not yet decided what to do about it. His expression was not quite amused, but something adjacent to it, something that, on a less disciplined face, might have become a smile. She felt color rise in her face. She straightened. "Your Grace," she said, with the dignity available to someone who has just been caught practicing a waltz alone. "The cross step before the turn," he said. "You are looking at your feet." She blinked. He crossed the room toward her. He stopped at the proper distance. He offered his hand. "May I?" he said, not quite a question, but not quite a statement either. She placed her hand in his. His other hand came to rest at her waist properly, correctly, exactly where it should be. He was not touching her, precisely. He was present at her waist, which was an entirely different thing, and yet the distinction was difficult to defend in the warm air of the ballroom with the low afternoon light across the polished floor. They danced without music. He set the rhythm with his lead and she followed it, the cross step falling naturally where it had refused to fall in her own practice, the turn coming without thought, because his guidance was clear and steady and absolutely certain. "You follow well," he said. The words were measured. The tone was not. There was something underneath them that had nothing to do with dancing instruction. "Only when I trust the lead," she answered. The room was very still. The light had shifted imperceptibly toward gold. His hand was warm at her waist. She was looking up at him. She had to look up. He was considerably taller. And for a moment, something moved across his face that was not control and not calculation, and not the careful management of a man maintaining appropriate distance. Then Pickwick arrived. He scratched at the partially open ballroom door with the particular determination of a small dog who considers closed doors an affront to his dignity. The scratch became a sustained rhythmic effort that was genuinely impossible to ignore. Then a small white body inserted itself through the gap and trotted across the polished floor, with its tail elevated in the manner of a chaperone arriving to address an unsatisfactory situation. He sat down between them. Charles looked down at the dog. He looked back at Violet. He released her hand and stepped back precisely one step, resuming his usual posture. "Your dog," he said, "has poor timing." "He is not my dog," Violet said. "He believes otherwise." She looked down at Pickwick, who had the satisfied expression of a duty fulfilled. She laughed. She did not plan to. It simply happened, a genuine, unguarded sound in the beautiful empty room, and she felt Charles's stillness change quality slightly, becoming something less like restraint and more like attention. She stopped laughing and looked at him. He was looking at her with an expression she could not read and could not look away from. "Thank you, Your Grace," she said. "For the lesson." "Of course," he said. She took Pickwick and left the ballroom. Charles stood alone in the room for several minutes after she was gone. He looked at the chandeliers. He looked at the polished floor. He looked at the space she had occupied. He was 60 years old. She was 25. She was his aunt's paid companion, living under his roof, socially exposed in all the ways Victorian society made its weapons felt against women without money or rank. His attention toward her had already been noticed by the household, he was certain. His household was loyal, but they were human. He was already imagining things he had no right to imagine. He left the ballroom and went to his study and worked through correspondence until well past midnight, which was what he did when he needed to empty his mind of something it was insisting on holding. The ball itself arrived on a Saturday evening, with cold, clear weather and a sky so thick with stars that the carriage approach to Ashcroft Abbey was lit without torches. Candles filled every window, the chandeliers blazed. The sound of the string quartet spilled through the opened ballroom doors and down the corridor, and all the way to the entrance hall where Violet stood with Lady Beatrice and watched Northumberland society arrive. She was wearing pale blue. Lady Beatrice had produced the gown from a wardrobe that officially contained nothing of Violet's size and had presented it with the specific vagueness of a woman who had planned this in advance and was performing surprise. The gown was silk, soft, with cream trim at the collar and sleeves, and a waist that had been let out slightly to fit by Mrs. Holloway, who had completed this task without comment. Violet had protested that it was too fine for a companion. Lady Beatrice had said, "Nonsense. It is too fine for most of the women who will be here, which is rather the point," and had moved on. The blue suited her. She knew it did. She also knew that wearing it was a decision with social consequences, and she wore it anyway, because she was tired of making herself smaller than she was. She was greeting the third arriving couple, when she felt it a shift in Charles's attention from across the entrance hall. She did not look immediately. She let the feeling settle, the particular physical awareness of being seen by a specific person, and then she looked. He was standing at the edge of the hall, speaking with the Viscount Lockwood, and he was not looking at Viscount Lockwood. He was looking at Violet in her pale blue dress, with an expression that lasted approximately 2 seconds before he replaced it with the correct social face of a duke receiving his guests. 2 seconds was enough. Viscount Lockwood noticed. Viscount Lockwood's wife noticed. Two ladies near the ballroom door noticed. Fans were raised. Glances were exchanged. Violet understood. She had understood from the moment she put the gown on. She met the whispers with a straight back, and continued doing her work. The ball was beautiful. The tenants raised more than the three cottages needed. The food was excellent. Lady Beatrice danced once with a very elderly earl, who seemed delighted by the opportunity, and Pickwick was discovered 3 times in the ballroom, before finally being confined to the sitting room under the guard of a very sympathetic footman. Sebastian Vaughan arrived at 9:30. He had not been invited. He could not be publicly refused. This was a social reality of Victorian England that Charles understood and despised simultaneously, and Violet saw, the moment Charles was informed of Sebastian's arrival, a subtle tightening of the jaw, a stillness that was different from his usual stillness, a deliberate recalibration. Sebastian made his way through the ballroom with the practiced ease of someone very accustomed to rooms. He was handsome, still dark-haired, well-dressed, with the kind of easy social confidence that Violet had once found reassuring and now understood was a kind of performance. He greeted people he knew with warmth. He worked his way toward her. "Miss Clark," he said, when he reached her. He said it as though her name were something he was returning to its owner after keeping it for some time. What a pleasant surprise. "Lord Vaughan," she said. He smiled. His smile had always been very good. "You look well. The North air agrees with you." He glanced around the ballroom with the expression of a man making a calculation. "Ashcroft Abbey. Quite an establishment for a lady's companion." "Lady Beatrice is very kind," Violet said. "I imagine many in this household are kind to you," he said pleasantly. "The Duke in particular has a reputation for generosity with those under his care." The words were smooth. The implication beneath them was not. Around them, the nearest guests had gone quiet in the particular way that indicates they are listening while appearing not to. Sebastian continued, still pleasantly, to a nearby gentleman. "Lord Kensington, have you met Miss Clark? She was once intended for me, but she has always been drawn to older men of influence. It seems to be something of a..." "Lord Vaughan." Charles's voice was very quiet. It was the quietness of a large amount of controlled force. He had crossed the room without hurrying. He stood beside Violet, not in front of her, not between them in a way that made her invisible, but beside her, at the precise angle that made his position unambiguous. "You are a guest in my house, Lord Vaughan," he said. "Try to remember the distinction between conversation and insult." The ballroom was silent for a very specific 5 seconds. Sebastian's smile did not waver, but his eyes did something cold. He bowed slightly. "Of course, Your Grace. Forgive me." He moved away. Charles did not watch him go. He looked at Violet. She met his eyes and saw in them an anger held on a very short leash, and under the anger, something that was almost helplessness, the anger of a man who wanted to do more than the rules of his position permitted. "Are you well?" he said. "Yes," she said. "Thank you." He nodded once and returned to his guests. Violet stood in the blue silk dress amid the candlelight and the music and the resumed social noise of the ball, and she felt the warmth of his presence at her side still, even after he had stepped away. She felt it as clearly as she had felt his hand at her waist in the empty ballroom, a warmth that was not only physical but structural, as though having someone stand beside her had changed the architecture of the room. Sebastian left before midnight. He did not speak to her again, but the damage had already found its audience, and by the time the carriages were called and the candles were being snuffed, the whispers had already organized themselves into narratives. Late that night, Charles sat in his study and stared at the correspondence he had been staring at for an hour without reading. He thought about Sebastian Vaughan's face. He thought about Violet's face, her stillness under the attack, her composure, the thing she had been holding steady beneath it, that he recognized because he had been holding something similar for 30 years, and he knew its shape. He thought about what Sebastian had implied and what the room had heard. He thought about the pale blue dress. He thought about the fact that his attention to Violet had already been noticed, and that noticed attention, in Victorian England, in a room full of people looking for something to talk about, was as dangerous to a woman of her position as an open accusation. He took a sheet of paper from the desk drawer and picked up his pen. He wrote a letter to Lady Cordelia Kensington in Bath, inquiring about the possibility of a companion's post. He sat and looked at the letter when it was done. He sent it in the morning. 3 days after the ball, the abbey was quiet again. The guests had gone. The flowers had been cleared. The ballroom had been closed, not sealed as it had been, simply closed, as rooms are closed when the occasion for them is past. Charles had become courteous in the way that is worse than coldness. Violet noticed it on the first day. He spoke to her at meals. He asked after Lady Beatrice. He made no reference to the ball. He sat across from her and ate his meals with precise social correctness, and looked at her in the manner of a man who had decided something and was arranging himself around that decision. She waited. On the fourth evening, He sent a note to the sitting room asking if Miss Clark would be so good as to meet him in the Winter Gallery at 8 o'clock. The Winter Gallery was a long corridor on the upper floor, glass-windowed on one side and portrait-hung on the other, an architectural feature of Ashcroft Abbey that served no purpose except grandeur, running the full length of the north wing and giving onto the moonlit moors on its open side. The ancestors of the Stirling line regarded the living from their frames, with expressions ranging from mild disapproval to active hostility. Snow was pressing against the windows. Blue moonlight lay across the marble floor in long, cold sheets. Charles was standing beneath the portrait of himself as a young man painted at 35, before Margaret's death, in the formal ducal tradition when Violet arrived. He looked at that portrait sometimes. She had noticed this. He looked at it the way a man looks at evidence. She stood before him in the blue moonlight and waited. "I have been in correspondence with Lady Cordelia Kensington in Bath," he said. "I believe I have secured for you a very respectable post as companion to her household. Lady Kensington is an intelligent woman, well-connected, generous to her staff. The position would..." "Have I displeased you, Your Grace?" He stopped. "No," he said. "Have I embarrassed you?" "No." "Have I performed my duties to Lady Beatrice inadequately?" "No." "Violet." It was the first time he had used her given name, without her title. He heard it as she heard it. He stopped. She looked at him. "Then why are you sending me away?" The gallery was very quiet. Snow tapped at the glass on a breath of wind. The ancestors waited. Charles was silent for a long moment. Then he said the thing he had been building toward for weeks, the thing that was both true and cowardly, and the best and worst of what fear can produce in an intelligent man. "Because you are 25 years old, Violet. I am 60. I am old enough to be spoken of as your ruin, and titled enough to make that ruin permanent." He looked at her directly. "You are too young for an old duke." The words sat between them in the cold blue air. She did not respond immediately. She absorbed them the way she absorbed most difficult things quietly, with her face very still and her eyes very clear, her composure, the kind that costs something. Then she stepped toward him, not recklessly, not dramatically. One deliberate step, closing half the distance between them, close enough now that she was looking up at him in the moonlight, with all the clarity and precision she had been assembling for months. "You have mistaken society's cruelty for wisdom," she said. "You have looked at the whispers and called them truth, because the truth is more frightening." He was very still. "I am not in love with your title," she said. His jaw tightened. A muscle moved in his cheek. "I am not in love with Ashcroft Abbey, nor your carriages, nor your name in Parliament. I am not dazzled by the dukedom or seduced by the estate. I know what those things are. I have lived near enough to them to see exactly what they cost." She held his gaze. She would not be the first to look away. "I am in love with the man who remembers how I take my tea. The man who forgave a widow's rent and told no one. The man who placed his coat over my shoulders in the cold library and then walked away, because wanting to be kind to me frightened him." Her voice was steady, entirely steady, though her chest was not. "The man who stands in doorways because he wishes to enter and does not think himself permitted." His breath changed. She saw it, the controlled rise and fall of him shifting, becoming something less mechanical. She reached for his hand, both hands at her sides and then one of them rising, finding his in the moonlight, her fingers resting over his, warm against cold. He did not pull away. She felt every point of contact with a precision that had nothing to do with temperature. His hand was large, still, and for a moment one contained. Enormously charged moment, his fingers closed slightly. Not enough to be called a grip, enough to be called an answer. "To me," she whispered. "You're perfect, Your Grace." The gallery held its breath. His eyes, for the first time in her experience of him, were entirely unguarded. She could see everything in them, the longing and the terror, and the 12 years of practiced emptiness, and underneath it all, still alive, still entirely real, the man who had fallen in love with her, in a library, and a conservatory, and an empty ballroom, and had been trying very hard ever since to be noble about it. "You do not know what you are asking," he said. His voice was rough at the edges. "I know exactly what I am asking," she said. "I have been asking it with full knowledge of the consequences since the night in the conservatory, when you held my hand in the cold and did not let go until you thought it was safe." He looked at her for a long time. His hand was still in hers. "You deserve," he began. "I will tell you what I deserve," she said, quietly. "I know that better than you." She did not step back. She did not soften the thing between them into something safer. He said, "You should have a young man, someone whose name is not already weighted with history. I have already been offered youth and history and beauty and all the social eligibility a woman could want," she said. "I ran from it." He looked at her. She saw the question. She told him about Sebastian. She told him plainly, without drama, the way she told most important truths, simply, and letting the simplicity carry the weight. She told him about the careful possession disguised as courtship. She told him about the decisions made as though her opinions were a stage of consultation already cleared. She told him about the note slipped under the door of her room at Ashcroft Abbey 3 weeks ago, warning her that her past was coming. As she spoke, she watched Charles's face change. Not quickly. He was a man whose face had been trained for decades not to change quickly. But something was moving through him. Something that had force. "Someone in this house wrote you that note," he said. "Yes. And you did not come to me." I was not yet certain of what I had found. "I do not make accusations without evidence, Your Grace." He looked at her. Something shifted in him. "Archibald," he said slowly. She said nothing. She let him arrive at it himself, because a man of Charles's intelligence needed only the direction and not the arrival. The word had barely formed in the air between them when Pickwick, who had been somewhere in the far end of the corridor following his own investigation, began to bark. Sharply. Repeatedly. The bark of a small dog who has found something he considers requires immediate human attention. Then, from somewhere in the west wing, a maid's voice, sharp with shock. Charles and Violet looked at each other. They moved. The west library was lit when they reached it. Two of the wall sconces had been lit, not the central lamp, the careful, minimal lighting of someone who did not want to be seen from outside, but needed to see well enough to work quickly. The estate record volumes that Violet had noted weeks ago were spread across the central reading table, some open, some stacked. A locked cabinet in the south corner stood open. Archibald Warren stood beside the cabinet. He held a leather pouch that he had clearly not expected to still be there. Agnes, the parlor maid with the cough, stood near the door. It was Agnes who had screamed. She had come to return a lamp left in the library, and found Warren in the semi-dark with the cabinet open, and something in the scene had made her understand. In the instinctive way that comes to servants who have been watching a household for years, that she was witnessing something she was not supposed to witness. She looked terrified. Warren looked at her with the expression of a man making a rapid calculation. Charles and Violet arrived at the same moment. Warren's calculation changed entirely. He straightened. He composed himself with the speed of a man who had spent 30 years managing crises in someone else's name. He turned to Charles with the expression of measured concern and faint disapproval that he kept ready for situations where he needed to be believed. "Your Grace," he said, "I am glad you are here. I came to check the accounts and found the cabinet had been accessed. Miss Clark was in this library late in the evening, several weeks ago. I am afraid I did not wish to mention it at the time, but..." "Miss Clark will be heard," Charles said. Warren stopped. The three words landed in the room with the quiet authority of a man who does not need to raise his voice. Charles had not raised his voice. He had simply redirected the architecture of the conversation, and in that redirection, everything changed. Warren tried again. "Your Grace, I have served this estate for..." "Miss Clark." Violet stepped forward. She was aware of Warren's eyes on her, the particular pressure of a man who has been using his position as a shield and is only now calculating whether the shield will hold. She did not look at him. She looked at Charles. The coal deliveries listed in the accounts for the third and fourth quarters of this year show full payment against deliveries marked complete, she said. The tenants on the north side of the estate, seven cottages, including the widow Mrs. Faulkner in the east cottage, received no coal, or far less than recorded, since September. The discrepancy between the recorded deliveries and the actual deliveries runs to a significant sum. She paused. I also found that a widow named Mrs. Randolph has been charged rent for October and November. The rent was forgiven by you in August, Your Grace, in writing. The written forgiveness does not appear in the current records, Warren said. These are the speculations of a young woman who does not understand estate accounting. Then explain the receipts, said Charles. He was looking at the leather pouch in Warren's hand. Warren looked at it too, as if just remembering it was there. Pickwick, who had arrived at some point during the preceding exchange and had been conducting his own methodical investigation of the room's lower quadrant, selected this moment to drag something out from beneath the cabinet with tremendous effort and considerable self-congratulation. It was a second pouch, smaller, which had been tucked into the gap between the cabinet and the wall. He deposited it at Violet's feet, sneezed once, and sat back with the air of a professional. Lady Beatrice, who had materialized in the doorway behind Charles in a magnificent dressing gown and without her evening hairpiece, said, I have said for years that Pickwick understands finance better than most men. The second pouch contained receipts for partial deliveries made to tenants, receipts with amounts that did not match the accounts, notes in Warren's own careful handwriting that described, in the undisguisable language of someone who had been doing this for years, exactly how the estate funds had been redirected. Warren did not speak again. Charles dismissed him. He did it quietly, without raising his voice. He told Warren that the magistrate would be contacted in the morning, and that Warren was to remain in his quarters until that time. He told Mrs. Holloway, who had also appeared in the doorway, because Ashcroft Abbey had the particular acoustic quality of a house where nothing remains private for long to arrange for Warren's movements to be noted. Warren left. His step in the corridor was not the step of a man defeated. It was the step of a man recalculating. Charles stood for a moment in the emptied library. Agnes was still by the door, visibly shaking. Violet turned to her. Agnes, she said. Will you tell Mrs. Holloway you are to have tomorrow morning free from duties and your tea brought up? You have done nothing wrong. You were very brave. Agnes left with Mrs. Holloway. Pickwick inspected the empty cabinet. Lady Beatrice found a chair. Charles turned to Violet. I should have listened sooner, he said. She had not been expecting it so directly. She looked at him. You are the person who saw it first. You came to me with what you had found, and I told you I trusted Warren. He was looking at her with the expression that was not quite guilt and not quite admiration, but somewhere between them, the expression of a man revising a significant assumption about himself. I was wrong. I apologize. You apologize to me, she said, in front of the household. I was wrong in front of the household. She looked at him for a moment. Something in her chest did what it always did when he was honest, the particular ache of recognizing someone who tells the truth, even when it is uncomfortable. Thank you, she said. Lady Beatrice cleared her throat from her chair. They both looked at her. She was holding something. A letter. Old. The envelope sealed with wax that had been left untouched for 12 years. She held it out toward Charles with both hands, as though the weight of it were not physical but something else. I have been waiting, she said, for the right moment. I believe this may be it. Charles crossed the room and took the letter from her. He looked at the handwriting on the front. He went very still. It was Margaret's handwriting, Lady Beatrice said quietly. She gave it to me 3 days before she died. She said I would know when the time was right. I have been wrong about the time before. Her eyes moved briefly to Violet and back. I do not think I am wrong now. Charles stood for a long moment with the letter in his hands. Then he left the room. Quietly. With the measured step of a man carrying something fragile. Violet watched him go. She sat with Lady Beatrice for an hour, drinking cold tea that neither of them tasted. Lady Beatrice told her, without being asked, about Margaret Stirling, not the formal version, not the version covered in black velvet, but the real one. The woman who had been sharp-minded and practical, and who had loved Charles with a specificity that came from truly knowing someone, not from knowing what they were supposed to be. She worried about him, Lady Beatrice said. More than he ever knew. She knew what grief did to men who had been trained to call endurance a virtue. She told me once that she was more afraid of Charles surviving her without living than she was of anything else. Violet was quiet. She was right to worry, Lady Beatrice said. He has been enduring magnificently for 12 years. The chapel was at the east end of the Abbey's ground floor, a small stone room with 4 pews and a window of colored glass that turned whatever light came through it into something else entirely. Charles sat in the front pew with Margaret's letter open in his hands for a long time before he read it. When he read it, it took him 8 minutes. He read it once quickly, then sat for a while, then read it again slowly. Margaret wrote the way she had spoken directly, with warmth that never became sentimental, with precision that never became cold. She told him that she knew him. She told him that she had known from the first year of their marriage that he would outlive her not because she had any knowledge of how, but because she understood the particular stubbornness of the man she had married and did not think death would have an easy time of him. She told him that she had been content, that their life together had been genuinely good and genuinely real, and she did not want it idealized after the fact into something too perfect to live beside. She told him that grief is a form of love, and that she would never ask him to stop grieving. But that grief, left alone in a house too long, becomes something else, she told him. If one day someone makes you laugh in a room where you thought only ghosts could sit, do not send her away for my sake. I did not love you so poorly as to want that, she told him. The letter I would have written to a smaller man would have asked him to be faithful to my memory. This letter is written to you. I am asking you to be faithful to your life. Charles sat in the chapel for some time after he finished reading. The colored window sent blue and gold across the stone floor. The abbey was very quiet. He sat in the quiet and let the letter be what it was, not absolution, which implied he had done something wrong, but release. The release of being known by someone who loved him and told him the truth even in the last letter she would ever write. He thought about Violet in the winter gallery. He thought about her hand on his in the moonlight. He thought about the way she had said, to me, you're perfect, your grace, not with the softness of a woman saying something beautiful, but with the steadiness of a woman stating what she knew. He thought about the 12 years he had spent choosing what was expected over what was true. He thought about what Margaret had written. I'm asking you to be faithful to your life. He folded the letter carefully. He placed it in his breast pocket, near his heart, which was the correct place for a letter like that. He stood. He left the chapel and walked through the east wing for the first time in 12 years. He walked its corridors with the lantern in his hand, passing the closed doors with a different quality of presence than he had managed before. Not closure, not ceremony. Simply walking through a space that had held grief, and finding it could also hold him. He came out of the east wing at the north corridor. He walked to the ballroom. He tried the door. It opened easily. The staff had not yet relocked it after the ball. He stood in the doorway of the dark ballroom. The chandeliers were unlit, but the moonlight from the long windows fell across the floor in the same blue that had lit the winter gallery, and the room was enormous and beautiful, and full of the particular expectation of a space built for people and waiting for them. He walked to the center of the floor. He stood there for a moment with his lantern and the moonlight and the abbey breathing around him. Then he walked to the door and told Thomas, who was still awake in the corridor with the quiet vigilance of a first footman on a difficult night, to inform Miss Clark in the morning that the Duke requested her presence in the ballroom at 8 o'clock, Thomas went. Charles stood in the ballroom a while longer. In the morning room down the hall, Violet sat at the window and looked at the moonlit grounds, and thought about a man reading a letter in a chapel. She did not know what the letter said. She did not need to know. She thought about his voice when he had said, "Miss Clark will be heard," and the way the room had changed with those four words. She thought about his hand in the winter gallery. She thought about 12 years of practiced emptiness, and whether a person could find their way back from that far. She thought, "Someone will have to go first." She already knew it would be her. It had already been her. She had already crossed the room in the blue moonlight and taken his hand and said the truest thing she had in her. She hoped it had been enough. The morning of the 15th of December was clear. This was unusual for Northumberland in winter. Unusual enough that Agnes mentioned it when she brought Violet's morning tea and Mrs. Holloway mentioned it to the kitchen staff, and even Pickwick, who had appeared in Violet's room before anyone opened the curtains, sat on the windowsill for an unusual length of time looking at the blue sky with the expression of an animal making a judgment. Violet dressed carefully. Not with ceremony, she was not going to a ball or receiving guests. She wore the grey wool dress she wore for working mornings, the one that was neither too fine nor too plain, the one she had worn the day Charles found her in the library with the estate records and his coat over her shoulders. She went downstairs at 8 o'clock. Thomas was waiting outside the ballroom door. He opened it without speaking. The ballroom was lit, not with candles, though several stood in the sconces along the walls. The morning light was the source, the long December sun coming through the great east windows at an angle that turned the floor into a mirror, so that the whole room seemed to hold two copies of itself, one solid and one made of light. The chandeliers had been arranged so their crystal caught the sun and threw it in small moving pieces across the ceiling and the walls, and the effect was something between a ballroom and a garden in full afternoon. The flowers from the ball had been cleared, but someone had placed a simple arrangement of winter heather on the mantelpiece of the north fireplace. The small purple kind that grew near the old shepherd's wall on the north field. Violet stood in the doorway and looked at the room. Charles was standing at the far end by the windows. He turned when she came in. He was not wearing his formal coat. He wore the dark grey morning coat she saw him in most days, simply cut, without embellishment, the coat of a man who dressed for the day ahead, rather than for observation. He looked like himself, which was something she had not always seen in him, the version of Charles Stirling that was not performing the dukedom. He looked older in the morning light. She noticed this, and felt nothing except tenderness toward it. The silver of his hair, the lines around his eyes, the body that had carried 60 years, and the grief of 12 of them, and the weight of a position that had never asked him what he wanted. He looked like a man who had been waiting. He said, "Good morning." "Good morning," she said. The ballroom was quiet between them. Pickwick, who had followed her from her room, trotted past her into the room with dignified purpose and positioned himself near the north fireplace. "I read Margaret's letter," Charles said. "She waited. She was not who I had been keeping." He stopped. Tried again. "The woman I have been guarding in locked rooms and black velvet was not Margaret. She was an idea I made from grief, and I dressed her in Margaret's name because I did not know what else to do with the weight of losing her." He looked at Violet steadily. "Margaret's letter asked me to live." Violet's chest ached with a gentleness she did not try to contain. "And Archibald," he said. "The magistrate will handle it," she said. "And the tenants?" "The tenants will be made whole before winter is out. All of it." He paused. "Including Mrs. Faulkner's roof." She remembered Lady Beatrice mentioning Mrs. Faulkner's roof at the breakfast table when arguing for the ball. She felt something warm move through her. "I came here," she said quietly, "to disappear." "I know. I came because I was running from something, and because this house seemed large enough to hide in, and because your aunt was kind enough to offer me a door. I know that too," he said. "I did not expect..." She stopped. "I did not expect you," He crossed the room toward her. Slowly, with the deliberateness of a man who has decided something and is not going back from it. Not the decision of impulse, but the decision of a man who has been patient with himself long enough and is done being patient, he stopped before her, at a proper distance, and held out his hand. "Will you dance with me?" he said. She placed her hand in his. They had done this before, in this same room, with the afternoon light and the uncomfortable awareness of what they were not saying. It was different now. His hand was certain. Hers was not performing confidence. There was nothing to pretend between them, and the relief of that of simply being what she was in a room with a person who already knew her was something she had not known. She was waiting for. They moved together on the polished floor. No music. Only the light through the east windows, and the sound of the old house breathing, and the quiet of two people who had come, by very different paths, to the same place. She was looking up at him. He was looking down at her with the full attention of a man who has decided to stop dividing himself. They slowed, then stopped. He was still holding her. Her hand in his at her back, the winter light between them. "I have been operating under the assumption," he said, "that my age, my grief, and my title were reasons not to ask for what I want." She felt her heart shift. "And have you revised that assumption, Your Grace?" "Completely." He released her hand to reach into his breast pocket. He drew out a ring sapphire, deep blue, set in gold. The kind of ring that has a history. Margaret's ring. She recognized it from the portrait in the yellow sitting room, the one that had been uncovered, the one that had shown Margaret laughing at something outside the frame. He did not hold it out immediately. He held it between his fingers in the morning light and looked at her. "This is not a replacement," he said. "It is a passage. It carries what was good and goes forward. That is what Margaret asked me to do." She looked at the ring. She looked at his face. "Violet Clark," he said, with the particular gravity of a man for whom words are chosen rather than produced. "I cannot promise you youth. I cannot promise you a simple life. I cannot promise that society will be kind, or that the years ahead will hold only easy things." He looked at her directly, without softening it, without making it easier than it was. "But I can promise you truth, loyalty, my protection when you need it, and my respect when you do not. Every tenant petition read with your name beside mine. Every morning fire lit in whatever room you prefer, and every remaining day God grants me, spent as honestly as I know how to spend it." A tear came. She did not try to stop it. She let it be what it was. "That," she said, "is more than enough." He put the ring on her finger. It fit perfectly. This, she suspected, was not coincidence. Lady Beatrice was going to be unbearably pleased with herself. From across the room, Pickwick sighed a long, satisfied sound of a small dog who has been supervising a situation for months and is deeply relieved to see it concluded. Charles looked at the dog. He looked at Violet. Something moved across his face, that thing that was not quite a smile but was becoming one, still learning the shape of itself. "That dog," he said, "has been managing this household." "He has excellent instincts," Violet said. The door opened. Lady Beatrice appeared in it wearing her dressing gown, and a magnificent expression of surprise that fooled neither of them. "Oh," she said, "are you finished? Aunt Beatrice. Pickwick, come." She clicked her fingers. Pickwick did not come. He remained where he was, with the certainty of a dog who considers the matter not yet formally closed. "He has waited months for this," Lady Beatrice said, addressing Charles rather than the dog. "He is not going to be rushed at the finish." Charles looked at Violet. She looked at him. And then quietly, genuinely, in the morning light of the reopened ballroom, he laughed. A real laugh. Unpracticed. The laugh of a man who has been surprised by his own happiness. It was the first time she had heard it. She thought she might spend the rest of her life making sure it was not the last. Sebastian Vaughan made one final effort in January. He had come from London with a story and the social leverage to spread it, the narrative of an ambitious young woman who had pursued a lonely old duke and secured herself a title she had never deserved. Charles did not hide. He had never hidden from anything in his life. He made the announcement of their engagement in the proper way, through the proper channels, with his name and hers, and the date of their intended wedding in print. He sent the announcement personally to every member of Parliament he knew, to every magistrate in the county, and to the three Northumberland families whose opinions carried the most social weight in that corner of England. He also, through his solicitor, provided the appropriate legal bodies with the documentation relating to Archibald Warren's misappropriation of estate funds, which documentation included the receipts found by Pickwick under the cabinet and the ledger irregularities identified by Violet over the preceding weeks. Warren's removal and prosecution proceeded quietly but thoroughly. Sebastian's debts, which had been accumulating behind his beautiful manors for several years, came to light through the same legal process. He left for the continent in March. The whispers in London did not stop. Charles had not expected them to stop. He had learned, at 60 years old, the difference between what can be controlled and what simply must be outlasted. Violet had known that difference since she was 19. They were married on the 3rd of February, 1880, in the chapel at Ashcroft Abbey, with the winter light coming through the coloured window and throwing blue and gold across the stone floor. Violet wore ivory with a blue ribbon, the exact shade of Margaret's sapphire ring. Lady Beatrice wept with the theatrical precision of a woman who has been rehearsing the moment. Before the wedding breakfast, at Charles's direction, the black velvet was taken down from Margaret's portrait in the upper gallery. She looked out from the canvas with clear eyes and the expression of a woman who knew something. The portrait had been painted the year she and Charles married. She was 31, dark-haired, with a directness in her gaze that Violet recognized, not because it resembled her own, but because it resembled the gaze of a woman who had decided what mattered and was not interested in pretending otherwise. Violet stood before the portrait for a moment. She said, silently, the only thing there was to say, "Thank you for knowing him." The abbey changed after the wedding. Not all at once. Not dramatically. The way light changes when a curtain is drawn back incrementally, and then completely. The conservatory was repaired in March, and Violet filled it with plants through the spring and summer until it was green and warm and smelled of growing things. She spent her mornings there when the estate business did not call her elsewhere, and Charles developed the habit of bringing his correspondence to the conservatory table, ostensibly because the light was better, and never quite admitting that what was better was the company. He asked her opinion on estate matters, not as a courtesy, not as a gesture, because her opinion was consistently correct, and he was a man who valued accuracy over convention. The tenant cottages on the north side received their coal before the 1st of October. Mrs. Faulkner's roof was repaired in April. The accounts were overseen by a new steward, a younger man, meticulous, who had grown up on the estate, and whom Violet had quietly recommended after watching him manage three crises during the Warren transition with a composure that reminded her of someone. Lady Beatrice declared that she had arranged everything. No one disputed this, because she was right about enough of it that the parts she hadn't arranged were not worth arguing over. Pickwick grew older and more important. He developed strong opinions about which chair in the drawing room was his, which footman was permitted to approach him without invitation, and where in the morning room his afternoon sleep was least likely to be disturbed. He also developed an intermittent cough that the veterinary surgeon declared a matter of character rather than health. He lived to 14, which was longer than most small dogs, and which Lady Beatrice attributed to moral fiber. His successor was a small white Bichon Frise named Figgins, delivered to Lady Beatrice's sitting room by a neighbor's recent litter, and who demonstrated within the first week a talent for escape, an opinion of Archibald Warren's replacement that was fortunately positive, and a deep personal attachment to the space at the foot of Violet's bed. The abbey did not become noisy. it did not become different in its essential character. It remained Ashcroft Abbey, ancient, stone, Northumberland, capable of silence that held weight and mist that sat on the moors and corridors that remembered things. But the quality of its quiet changed. It was no longer the quiet of something held back. It was the quiet of something content. 10 years later, in the conservatory, while December rain tapped the glass roof in the patient way it had been tapping the glass of Ashcroft Abbey for generations, Charles Sterling sat in the chair beside the large tropical plant Violet had acquired in a moment of optimism in 1882, and which had flourished beyond all reasonable expectation, and read his correspondence with the ease of a man at home. He was 70 years old. Violet was 35. She sat across from him with a book in her lap that she was not reading, because she was looking out at the rain instead, at the moors beyond the glass, the grey-green winter of the north, the familiar and beloved and perpetually dramatic landscape that had become, over 10 years, as much her home as any place she had ever known. Figgins, on the hearthrug, snored with the self-importance of an heir. Charles set down his correspondence. "I was wrong, you know," he said. Violet looked at him. "About what?" "The winter gallery." He was looking at the rain. "I thought I was too old to be chosen. I thought choosing me would cost you something that could not be recovered." She waited. "I was wrong about that." He paused. "About most of it."
"You were very stubborn about being wrong," she said.
"I have always been stubborn."
"You have," she agreed.
"You have always been patient about being right." She considered this. "Only when it mattered." He was quiet for a moment. The rain said its various things against the glass. Figgins shifted and resettled with a small sound of contentment.
"You saw me as a man," Charles said. "Not as the dukedom, not as the title or the estate or the age on my face. You came into this house and saw what was underneath all of that."
He looked at her directly, fully, with the uncurtained attention he had learned to give her over 10 years of understanding that she would not be overwhelmed by being fully seen. "I have never known how to thank you for that adequately." She set her book aside. She crossed the conservatory to his chair and sat on its arm, which was not the most elegant of postures, but was warm and close, and exactly what she wanted. He settled his arm around her without ceremony, the way they had learned to be near each other simply, without making a production of it. She rested her head against his shoulder. The rain continued.
"Someone had to. Your Grace," she said.
Outside, the moors did what they had always done remained. The stone of Ashcroft Abbey remained. The portraits in their frames remained, including Margaret Sterling in the upper gallery, clear-eyed and knowing, watching the living with equanimity. And inside the conservatory, with the rain on the glass and the fire low and the old house breathing around them, Charles Sterling and Violet Sterling, née Clark, sat together in the ordinary, irreplaceable warmth of a life, chosen on purpose. There are men who make the mistake that lonely people make. They count years and call them evidence. They count grief and call it loyalty. They count whispers and call them truth. Violet counted differently. She counted the man who remembered lemon in her tea. The man who forgave a widow's rent and told no one. The man who stood in doorways because he wished to enter and did not think himself permitted. The man who opened a ballroom after 12 years because love had finally become louder than fear. The heart does not ask a title how old it is. It does not consult society before it knows. It looks at a person in the daily truth of their life and recognizes what is rare. Charles Sterling was 60 years old when Violet Clark arrived at Ashcroft Abbey. He believed his story had already ended. He was wrong. Sometimes the last door to open is the one a man has been standing before his whole life. If Charles and Violet's story touched your heart, please give this video a thumbs up. It truly means the world to this channel. Subscribe so you never miss a story like this one, and share it with someone who needs a beautiful love story today. Now drop a comment and tell me where in the world are you watching from. I read every single one. See you in the next story.